This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Gridiron Genius, a masterclass in winning championships and building dynasties in the NFL. This is the author, Michael Lombardi. For Millie, my summer win, without whom nothing else matters. Forward by Bill Belichick. A lot of people write books about football, but only a few of them have Mike Lombardi's credentials. In 1991, when I became the head coach of the Cleveland Browns, one of the first things that I addressed was our scouting system, and for that I turned to Mike Lombardi. Mike and I worked together on building a grading scale and value system for college scouting that would be consistent with our pro scale. Mike directed Dom Anneeley, our director of college scouting, and Jim Swartz, a college scouting assistant, to refine, cross-check, and re-cross-check that system until they had created something that still works today. Mike was brilliant. The value system and scouting manual that he developed were unique because each player's skill evaluation incorporated the priorities of our coaches, including Nick Saban, defense, Ozzie Newsome, offense, Scott O'Brien, special teams, Pat Hill and Kirk Ferentz, offensive line, and Jim Bates, defensive line. In each of the next 3 years, Mike and I read through literally every player in the NFL, as well as every player on our draft board, to make sure he was valued properly and might fit into our schemes. Our grades, which were closely monitored by Jim Schwartz, deviated from other systems, which graded players as starters and backups. Mike and Jim categorized non-starters into roles, and three-down players were valued more highly than first and second-down starters. Also, special teams players had real value in this system. It was and is no coincidence that our special team units in Cleveland and New England have consistently ranked near the top of the league. A decade later, when I became the head coach of the Patriots, I replaced the existing personnel system with the one Mike developed. Ernie Adams and Scott Pioli made some adjustments to it that reflected the changes in the NFL in personnel and schemes over the previous 10 years, but Mike's system never lost its usefulness. I have had the great fortune to have an outstanding staff of coaches and personnel people throughout my coaching career. Many have moved on to other programs in the NC2A as well as the NFL and took the fundamentals of Mike's system with them. The root of that system has been replanted so many times that it is all over the game today. Another of Mike's many strengths is his ability to dig up undervalued players. He was relentless in the pursuit of talent. In Cleveland, we had an outstanding offensive line made up of players that Mike had identified in college: Tony Jones, Wally Williams, Orlando Brown, long before they became some of the highest paid players at their position. Mike also signed defensive tackle Bob Dahl with the idea of converting him to the offense. He was soon starting at guard. In 2014, I hired Mike to assist me in New England. His knowledge and experience proved again to be invaluable as he helped me, Nick Cesario, and our staff assemble our Super Bowl 49 championship team. His recommendation to sign running back Deion Lewis and his successful pursuit of free agent David Andrews are just two examples of his many contributions to that team. Mike is one of the smartest people I have worked with. He has a thorough understanding not only of personnel, but of coaching, team building, and the salary cap too. His work ethic, attention to detail, and near photographic memory made him both valuable and versatile to me at the two organizations at which we work together. This is my chance to thank him for his contributions. Bill Belichick. Introduction. Jumping the route. Something just did not look right. Bill Belichick. With 26 seconds left in Super Bowl 49, the Seattle Seahawks had the ball at the one-yard line with three chances to advance the 36 inches Pete Carroll's team needed to defeat Bill Belichick's New England Patriots. Although the rest of the world believed the game was all but over, I knew the truth. Belichick had the Seahawks right where he wanted them. I had rejoined Belichick's staff about a year earlier in February of 2014. It was the culmination of 3 decades of my bearing witness to a handful of brilliant, driven men as they revolutionized America's real national pastime. My education began in 1984 when I was lucky enough to join Bill Walsh's staff as a scouting assistant at the beginning of the San Francisco 49er dynasty, and I have been taking notes ever since. After 4 years with Walsh, for whom I worked my way up to an area scout position, I moved on to Cleveland. By the time I left 9 years later, I was the Browns' director of pro personnel. But more important, along the way, I swapped one legendary mentor for another as Belichick arrived in 1991 to begin honing his head coaching skills. Then it was on to Oakland, where I spent a decade with the National Football League's last true maverick, Al Davis, as a senior assistant, the kind of vague title Davis handed out when he didn't want anyone to know what exactly was going on behind the curtain in Raiderland. After a return to Cleveland, this time to be the general manager, I found myself back with Belichick, this time in New England. My title with the Patriots, coaching assistant, did not begin to define my role as I was there to prepare the team for the college draft and free agency and to contribute to game planning. It was a mix of scouting and coaching with a little organizational health maintenance thrown in. By then, Belichick had been ensconced in New England for 14 years and was gaining traction as the greatest coach ever. Of any sport in any era, I was thrilled to be back in the fold. And then I showed up for my first day of work. It was a miserable winter day in Foxborough and an equally miserable setting. The pre-dawn staff meeting convened in a tiny, windowless subterranean bunker that was serving as Belichick's office while the stadium was being remodeled. Each time the famous coach brought up his team's horrendous goal line defense, the one that gave up 13 touchdowns and 2 field goals in 15 goal-to-go situations the previous season, his mood increasingly matched his surroundings, dark, cold, and ominous. All the men in the room were terrified, myself included, but to be completely honest, I was also curious to watch the master at work again. The problem that had his full attention was one of modern football's most challenging: how to evolve the goal line defense in an era of spread passing attacks. Here's the dilemma in a nutshell. The traditional goal line defense is known as a 6-2 for the 6 defensive linemen and the 2 linebackers who back them up in a large body attempt to clog an inside run game. The other 3 defenders are defensive backs, typically 2 fleet-footed corners and 1 hard-hitting safety, tasked with pass coverage. This scheme worked for decades because around the goal line, NFL offenses generally relied on dense power formations that replaced some receivers with blocking tight ends to bolster the short yardage run game and typically left some defensive backs with no one to cover. In the endless chess game that is NFL strategy, however, teams have begun to take more and more chances through the air in goal line situations, employing a spread formation that featured at least 3 receivers and forced the defense to cover the entire width of the field. Most significantly, a 3-wide receiver formation resulted in a very exploitable mismatch against a secondary with only 1 safety. "We need a traditional goal line defense that can also cover 3 receivers, Belichick told us, his mind churning through 1,000 different possibilities like a gridiron computer. The only way to do that was to replace the safety in a 6-2 with a 3rd corner who would be a better matchup for a speedy wide receiver. Doing that, however, would take one of New England's best players, safety Devin McCourty, off the field. Belichick weighed the risk and decided he was willing to take the chance. It wouldn't be easy. Often, taking away one element of an offense makes the defense vulnerable in other ways. I call it the Curly in the boat problem. The 3 Stooges are in a rowboat that springs a leak, and Curly has the bright idea to punch another hole in the hull to let the water out, creating, of course, a much bigger problem. That wasn't going to happen in New England. Belichick is a lot of things, but he's definitely not a stooge. Nor is he reckless. Indeed, as much an iconoclast as Belichick can be, as much of a rule breaker and gambler, he's also a traditionalist. The son of a football coach who believes that although practice doesn't make perfect, it gets you closer to perfection each time you do it. He is a five-tool leader, adept at strategy, tactics, preparation, execution, and what you might call situational intuition, the rare ability to know which among the first four is required and when. We worked over the next months throughout the entire offseason and preseason implementing and perfecting Bill's ingeniously simple goal line solution. Once the season started, though, we never encountered a situation that called for three-corner goal line formation, a 6-2 nickel, you might call it. Not one time. The same thing held true in the postseason against the Baltimore Ravens and the Indianapolis Colts. No cause to debut our goal line gamble. 7 months, hundreds of practices, thousands of man hours, and almost 24 preseason and regular season games had gone by. All the time and energy invested in perfecting Belichick's goal line wrinkle was looking very much like an utter waste. Until the Seahawks had the ball on our doorstep with 26 seconds left in Super Bowl 49. On that warm Arizona night, everybody could practically feel the time, the game, and some small part of Belichick's legacy slipping away. Well, everybody except Belichick, who wasn't worried about any of it. He wasn't about to drill a second hole in his rowboat. Instead, Bill was focused intently on the Seattle sideline. From his vantage point across the field at the University of Phoenix Stadium, he sensed confusion and indecision in his opponent. Something just did not look right, he told me later. Instead of calling a timeout, an eerily calm Belichick just stared straight ahead, a predator stalking his prey. Suddenly he burst into action, becoming the aggressor. Shouting into his headset, Belichick commanded, "Just play goal line." Except he didn't mean our traditional 6-2 goal line. Instead, our safeties coach Brian Flores yelled, "Malcolm, go!" And undrafted rookie Malcolm Butler entered the game as the third corner. Everyone had expected Belichick to take a timeout to preserve precious seconds for his team if they got the ball back after the Seahawks inevitably took the lead. Everyone, including Seattle's coach Pete Carroll. When no timeout came, I suspect it might have thrown him just a little. Whatever the case, Carroll looked to the field, saw six Patriots defensive linemen there, and yelled into his headset, "They're in goal line." His counter call, sending in three receivers, was intended to spread the field. Instead, it played right into Belichick's trap. I've studied the NFL's smartest men my whole career, and it's never anything less than breathtaking when you realize they are operating on a different level than their peers. Believing they had speed and horizontal space on their side, Seattle stacked two receivers on the right. At the snap, though, Butler, a cornerback skilled in man coverage, as opposed to the safety who ordinarily would have been in that spot, expertly read the play. He exploded toward wideout Ricardo Lockett, beating him to the ball and securing the most critical interception in Super Bowl history, not to mention yet another Lombardi trophy for Belichick and the Patriots. Someone wise once said, "The world gets out of the way for people who know where they are going." He might as well have been describing my 13-year-old self in the summer of 1972 when I discovered Strat-O-Matic baseball with my two best friends, Michael Cennino and Danny Reynolds. From the moment I opened the box on that early sports simulation game, I knew my calling. The weather along the Jersey Shore, made famous by Bruce Springsteen, was hot and humid, and the beach was just a 2-minute walk away, but the three of us pretty much stayed in my mother's air-conditioner-less kitchen from sunrise to sunset. The game, a precursor to fantasy that consisted of cards with outcomes informed by actual stats of real Major League Baseball players activated by dice throws, unleashed a passion in each of us. We made our rules, insisting on a 2-to-1 vote for any changes. We gave each player card a grade that was based on our own statistical analysis. We held league-wide drafts rather than accepting the teams as they were packaged. Each of us were fully committed to the dual roles of GM and coach for the team. To paraphrase the Hall of Fame football coach Bill Parcells, we not only shopped for the groceries, we cooked too. In other words, we were obsessed, except that the obsession extended far beyond childhood for me. Stratomatic, as I think back, gets the most credit for my love of scouting and team building. Later that decade, I transferred my obsession to the NFL draft. It wasn't anything like it is today, a significant event in a carefully scripted year-round NFL calendar that attracts millions of fans from all over the world. There was no television coverage for any of the rounds that started in 1980, let alone all of them. And so if you wanted to follow in real time, as I most certainly did, you had to make your way to the host hotel in New York City. Seats were limited, which meant, for me, taking an early Long Island Railroad train from Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, to make sure I got one. The palpable current of excitement and potential on draft day assured me that this was what I wanted to do for my life's work. Stratomatic aside, my first love was football since the moment in the late 1960s when I saw a man on our family's little black and white television who had the same last name as mine and who looked like one of my uncles. That man, Vince Lombardi, legendary Green Bay Packers coach, didn't have to be related to me to become my role model. Like most boys, I dreamed of one day suiting up in the NFL. Man, I wanted to play. And so I did, on Pop Warner teams, in high school in Ocean City, New Jersey, and then in a boarding school at Valley Forge Military Academy in Pennsylvania, which I attended in part to learn discipline, but also to stay on the field while I got my grades up so that I could attend a good college. By then I knew an NFL career was not in the cards. I was already good enough to evaluate my own athletic gifts as lacking, but I decided to go to a school somewhere that would allow me to prolong my career a bit longer as I figured out how to get a job on an NFL sideline or in a front office. College let me stay in the game, but it also let me learn the game. I spent weekends attending coaching clinics throughout the Northeast. Frat parties were not my thing. Football was the dream, and I chased it hard. In some ways, I'm still chasing. I often think about legendary baseball executive Branch Rickey, who, after being fired at the age of 74 as general manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, was asked to name his most significant accomplishment. Rickey, who among other achievements orchestrated Jackie Robinson's breaking of the Major League Baseball color barrier and invented the game's farm system, quickly replied, "It hasn't happened yet." Although this book is drawn from a lifetime spent in football front offices, it's not a life story as most are written. I won't bore you with tales of inspiring childhood coaches, though I certainly had them, or highlights from my own playing career. I had a few of those too. I will leave the teaching of technique and fundamentals to better instructors. There will be no extended treatises about the hand placement of the nose tackle or the footwork of the tight end. Although such nuances are the bones and ligaments of the game, I'm more interested in the entire body with an emphasis on the brain. Not only strategy and tactics that make a difference on the field, but philosophy and theory that matter off it. Football is ultimately a business, and as in any successful business, the most important ingredients are a sound culture, a realistic plan, strong leadership, and a talented workforce. Rather than a detailed recounting of my life and career, I save that for my kids. This book is meant to be an accounting of the lessons I've learned along the way. Lessons that I hope will be of interest to serious fans, but also to anyone who wants to know about what makes a great organizational thinker in any field, football or the Fortune 500. I will focus on lessons I've learned from the men who collectively are largely responsible for the modern game of professional football. Davis, the Hall of Fame Oakland Raiders owner-coach who was the beating heart of the pass-happy American Football League, which merged with and forever changed the stodgy NFL. Walsh, the Hall of Fame inventor of the West Coast offense, which continues to dominate the game today. And Belichick, who may understand more about what happens on the gridiron than anyone else in history. Each of these men have contributed to my PhD in advanced football. It's a degree that was 35 years in the making as I worked for, coached alongside, and managed men who have won 11 of those Lombardi trophies. Many of those wins the result of the kind of foresight, ingenuity, and sheer force of will displayed by Belichick during that goal line stand in Arizona. The story behind that now legendary play is just one of many that I have collected over my career, and if you have listened to my podcast work or read my pieces for The Ringer and elsewhere, you may recognize some of what I have to say here. But much more of it will be new. I could argue that no one has had as much direct access as I've had to the men most responsible for transforming pro football into the game it is today. And I would argue that no one is better suited to highlight and explain the brilliant lessons and revelatory insights of these masters. If you want to learn lifetime lessons, there's no better teacher than a lifetime student. Class begins now. Chapter 1. The Organization. Culture beats everything. Champions behave like champions before they're champions. Bill Walsh. Bill Walsh drove a Porsche. Well, he owned a Porsche, I should say, since I was the one who drove it. I was 25 in 1984 when I left a recruiting coordinator position at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, to join Walsh's staff with the San Francisco 49ers. The best part of my new job as a scout was to drive Walsh wherever he needed to go. As with most things in Walsh's world, there was no set pattern or agenda. Some days I just dropped him at home, other days I took him to the airport or to a speaking engagement across the state. For me, the longer the ride, the better. I could hardly believe my incredible good fortune. The assignment, considered by most to be grunt work suitable for only the youngest members of a staff, was nothing less than the beginning of my formal education in the game of professional football. What could be better? Me behind the wheel of a slick sports car as I listened to the running commentary of Bill Walsh, commentary on world events, or Villanova's NC2A tournament upset of Georgetown, or military history, or, his favorite subject above all others, the blueprint he was building for an advanced, all-encompassing philosophy that would transform the 49ers into the envy of and model for every other organization in sports. By the time I arrived, Walsh was well on his way to genius status. As a longtime assistant coach in Cincinnati under the legendary Paul Brown, Walsh first changed the course of NFL history with his invention of the West Coast offense. His intricate evolution of the passing game was built around precise timing and movement. It attacked the defense by stretching the field horizontally with short passes that served almost like handoffs, getting the ball to playmakers just as they reached top speed in open spaces. After a falling out with Brown, Walsh left the Bengals in 1975 and, after a brief stop in San Diego, spent 2 years as the head coach at Stanford, where he led the football team to back-to-back bowl game wins. Since he was comfortable in the school's academic environment, the last place anyone ever expected Walsh to jump to next was the 49ers. Most football fans today think of San Francisco as the NFL's dynasty of the 1980s, but few remember that before Walsh showed up in 1979, the team was widely regarded as the worst in the league and quite possibly the most dysfunctional franchise in all of pro sports. The previous general manager, Joe Thomas, had gutted the organization from top to bottom. Thomas fired 3 head coaches in less than 12 months, including one, East Coast native Pete McCauley, who insisted that everything run on his time. That meant the usual 7 a.m. team meetings began at 4 a.m. Thomas also cut talented players such as Jim Plunkett, who went on to win 2 Super Bowls with the Oakland Raiders. Worst of all, Thomas had traded away 5 of the 49ers' top picks in upcoming drafts for a washed-up, wobbly-kneed O.J. Simpson. The game day losses were so definitive, and the weekday atmosphere so poisonous during a 2-14 season in 1978 that a disgusted 49ers assistant left the sideline on one embarrassing Sunday to sit with his wife in the stands. In short, Walsh took over a team with no high draft picks, no quarterback, and no hope. 3 years later, that team won the Super Bowl. It got there by following Walsh's formula for what he called a standard of performance, an exacting plan for constructing and maintaining the culture and organizational DNA behind the perfect football franchise. Let's face it, the word perfect and the very idea of building the perfect organization are either cliches or fantasies to most coaches. Not to Walsh. Perfection drove him endlessly, and sometimes to those around him, maddeningly. His obsession with perfection meant he constantly pushed his people, regardless of experience or position in the organization, to learn more. He was naturally curious, always searching for ways to fix his team or just better accomplish the simplest task, and he demanded the same thing of his staff. He never wanted us to follow familiar paths to knowledge. He was trying to build a lasting, self-perpetuating culture to counter the groupthink that was then pervasive in the NFL and still is today. Walsh, in other words, was trying to disrupt football long before anyone thought to use that term in business, let alone sports. From his lectern in the passenger seat, Walsh told me, "If we are all thinking alike, no one is thinking." He was a master communicator, deftly asking questions he already knew the answer to as a lead into another lesson. "Have you heard of Tom Peters?" he once asked me. My first thought was, "Is he that punter in the draft?" When it quickly became clear that I had no clue who Peters was, Walsh began an impromptu dissertation on the merits of In Search of Excellence, the book that Peters, a famed management consultant, wrote with Bob Waterman. Walsh loved the book and urged me to head to the store immediately to buy a copy. There was no Amazon back then, which, of course, I did. And reading Peters spurred in me a lifelong love of his management philosophy, as Walsh knew it would. In the book, Peters and Waterman offer a list of 8 attributes that drive organizations to become excellent. The similarities to Walsh's standard of performance were no coincidence. Walsh himself said, "Running a football franchise is not unlike running any other business. You start first with a structural format and underlying philosophy, then find people who can implement it." But if football was his business, building the finest organization was his goal. The best way I can describe Walsh's philosophy is that he thought of a football team as being like a brand new automobile, believing that the finished product could only be as good as the assembly line that created it, all the way down to the tiniest bolt and the smallest detail performed by the seemingly most insignificant worker. Everything needed to mesh on and off the field. No part could survive without the others. It was a process Walsh was constantly thinking and rethinking as he built his culture of success. His meticulousness was evident, everywhere from his spotless sneakers to his impeccable office. Once as I was walking down the hall in the team facility, I heard him yell to me, "Are you just going to ignore that photo?" Unable to discern the offending picture, I asked him which one he meant. "The one that's tilted sideways," was his straightforward reply. To this day, if there's a picture hanging out of line, I am compelled to straighten it. Walsh was extremely demanding in a quiet way. You never wanted to be the source of that disappointed look on his face. He was a boxer in his younger days and a military buff as a grown-up. At the same time, he could have stepped in an economics class at Stanford and held forth quite proficiently. His was, in short, a unique and powerful presence wherever he went, particularly inside that Porsche, and his voice remains loud and clear in my ear today. Walsh's dedication to a standard performance was a way of life for him. His intention was to always use it to influence more than the game on the field. I truly believe that's why he left the comfort of Stanford for the challenge of the downtrodden 49ers. He wanted to test his theories in the worst possible circumstances at the highest level of the game. The fact that those theories passed that test with honors is a surprise to no one who knew the man in almost any capacity or context. Walsh left his legacy of greatness in players, coaches, and support staff alike. He was as concerned with how the receptionist answered the phones at the team headquarters as he was with Joe Montana's throwing motion. Once, during a preseason game at the 49ers' home stadium, Candlestick Park, I was in the coach's press box waiting for the team to return to the sideline after halftime. Suddenly, Walsh was screaming into my headset. When I asked him what he needed, he said bluntly, "Remind me to fire the PA announcer. He is horrible." That was classic Walsh, tuned in to all things 49ers, not just the action on the field. No detail was too small, not even the location of his parking spot at the team's facility inside the sprawling Red Morton Park recreational complex in Redwood City. He reserved the first space, closest to and aligned perfectly with the entrance for his Porsche. That was fine with me. Each time the call came to my desk from his assistant declaring that coach needs a ride, I got excited. My understanding of the 49ers' unique culture was about to be expanded again. Ever seen the Late Late Show's signature segment Carpool Karaoke? Host James Corden chauffeurs around music stars, a pop culture icon, or even a first lady as they sing along with the radio. But he also takes it as an opportunity to get them chatting about life. There's something about a car's interior, private yet informal, not to mention the duetting, that allows Corden to get an intimate glimpse into the thoughts of even the most guarded stars. Driving Walsh around in his Porsche was my version of Carpool Karaoke. Without the warbling, neither of us wanted to hear the other sing. I've worked with some of the greatest minds in football, and believe it or not, one common thread that bound them was a rather odd game show way of interacting with their staff. Starting in 1997, I spent almost a decade in Oakland working alongside the iconic owner of the Raiders, Al Davis, and he treated most of our interactions as if we were on Jeopardy. Davis, in the Alex Trebek role, required that I instantly furnish fully formed questions that were based on answers he threw my way. And Davis was nowhere as patient as Trebek. As soon as his secretary got me on the phone, he'd break into some version of this greeting. "I have three things for you." The number varied, but nothing else did. I never replied, instead just waited for the answer to number one. "You know that guy from Utah who missed a season with a knee injury?" Davis might say. My answer, "You mean offensive lineman Barry Sims?" Technically, I guess I should have said, "Who is offensive lineman Barry Sims?" "Yes, Sims," Davis would reply. "How big are his hands?" If I wasn't able to provide the exact measurement off the top of my head, I would be banned from Final Raider Jeopardy. The one thing you could never say to Al was, "I'm not sure, let me look it up." That drove him nuts. "Ah, fuck, Lombardi. I could look it up myself," he'd snap. That was my daily interaction with Davis for most of a decade. Book ended around my time with Davis. I worked with Bill Belichick in Cleveland and then again in New England. His game was closer to 20 questions. Detroit Lions general manager Bob Quinn worked on Belichick's staff for 16 years, and he recently described Bill's quiz show interrogation better than anyone. "It's 6:45 a.m. and you're still half asleep. As you wait in the line at the omelet station inside the Patriots practice facility, Belichick shuffles up and asks you a dozen questions about the seventh player on the practice squad. Those who weren't ready to engage in a half-hour in-depth conversation on the spot found themselves in the worst place in the NFL, Bill's doghouse. Walsh's concert was Carpool Karaoke. He liked to doodle, and in the same way that President Kennedy drew sailboats he daydreamed about building someday, Walsh drew up football plays from every era. If he caught me glancing over as he sketched, he would delight in giving me the play's background and origin. Walsh's mind never turned off, and writing things down seemed to be the best method he had to catalog his thoughts. He used 3x5 index cards and short, sharp pencils like the ones golfers keep score with, and when he wasn't doodling, he made lists of things that needed to get done in an elegant, left-handed handwriting that was part cursive, part print. Honestly, I think Walsh cherished those pencils more than the Porsche. In 1981, he signed veteran linebacker Jack Hacksaw Reynolds, who became the heart and soul of the 49ers defense that won two Super Bowls. In part, I'm sure, because Reynolds brought a box of sharpened pencils to every team meeting as if he were the world's toughest CPA about to meet with a client. Walsh, by the way, liked to say that whereas Hall of Fame defensive back Ronnie Lott had character, Hacksaw was a character, and he was right. Hacksaw got his nickname as a senior at the University of Tennessee when, after a frustrating loss to Mississippi, he went to Kmart, purchased 13 Hacksaw blades, and proceeded to cut through his 1953 Chevy. Anyway, with all this time to think and talk inside the Porsche, Walsh honed his standard performance, writing down its 17 principles with those beloved pencils. Walsh loved to teach more than anything, but a close second for him was making lists like this one. These tenets would inform the creation and maintenance of a football dynasty. 1. Exhibit a ferocious, intelligently applied work ethic directed at continual improvement. 2. Demonstrate respect for each person in the organization. 3. Be deeply committed to learning and teaching. 4. Be fair. 5. Demonstrate character. 6. Honor the direct connection between details and improvement. Relentlessly seek the latter. 7. Show self-control, especially under pressure. 8. Demonstrate and prize loyalty. 9. Use positive language and have a positive attitude. 10. Take pride in my effort as an entity separate from the result of that effort. 11. Be willing to go the extra distance for the organization. 12. Deal appropriately with victory and defeat, adulation and humiliation. 13. Promote internal communication that is both open and substantive. 14. Seek poise in myself and those I lead. 15. Put the team's welfare and priorities ahead of my own. 16. Maintain an ongoing level of concentration and focus that is abnormally high. 17. Make sacrifice and commitment the organization's trademark. The standard of performance was Walsh's attempt to instill a winning attitude in every member of his organization. In fact, as he admitted in his book, The Score Takes Care of Itself, he was far more focused on the process of creating culture, of establishing a foundation for sustainable success than in drawing up the perfect game plan. His standard of performance wasn't a way to define his genius. It was his genius. It was the compass that guided everything he oversaw, coaching, scouting, management, allowing him to transform the 49ers from a laughingstock to a powerhouse in fewer than 1,000 days. By accomplishing that feat, Walsh essentially used football to prove the famous dictum of another management expert, Peter Drucker. Culture can eat strategy for lunch. That's why for people inside the NFL, people in the know, Walsh's standard of performance is as much a part of his lasting impact as his West Coast offense, maybe even more. Because the Thomas era had been so destructive, Walsh had to rebuild every aspect of the organization, from the talent on and off the field to the quality of the workplace to the practice fields. No detail was too small for Walsh to consider because, to his assembly line way of thinking, only the sum of them all could produce the organization he wanted. As he was fond of saying, if he managed to perfect the culture, the wins would take care of themselves. And so he went about teaching the team not just about what to do, but how to think. The team facility was Walsh's classroom, and before long he had schooled everyone. He called meetings with each department, opened his notebook, and started a lecture on the essence of every job, how to act while doing each job, and most important, how to improve the way the job was done. When he lectured on culture and the way champions behave, he got locked in, never looking at his watch or wondering where he needed to be next. It was a rare and refreshing change from the way every other NFL team was run, with every minute scheduled, bathroom breaks included. Walsh's first student, and possibly the most important, was Eddie DeBartolo Jr., and the lesson he imparted was how to be an owner. DeBartolo knew he had made a mistake when he hired Thomas, giving so much authority to a man who wasn't the coach. Upon hiring Walsh, DeBartolo let everyone know that the coach was the boss, and made it clear that as the owner, he would never undercut Walsh's decision-making. That authority was key to Walsh's system because it created a hierarchy that avoided the common organizational fissures between the front office and coaches. Walsh knew that most teams in the NFL endured their share of internal strife, or as he referred to it, the Civil War. Walsh, both head coach and GM, eliminated a major source of headaches and inefficiency with a single job description. There would be no infighting or backstabbing or favoritism because he was the only voice talking to DiBartolo about the overall direction of the franchise. Walsh turned next to the members of the scouting department. He preached to us every day about the importance of learning the whole game, of being more than typical college scouts whom he belittled as former bad coaches telling good coaches what to do. Of course, this required that we go above and beyond anything we had done before. It was, however, in accordance with the first rule of his standard of performance. Exhibit a ferocious and intelligently applied work ethic. Work smarter, he said, not longer. He wanted us to see players not as a collection of data and stats, but in the context of the schemes they ran. To Walsh, grading a player without understanding the role coaches were asking him to fill was not only scouting blindly, it was just plain lazy. We needed to scout inside out, not outside in. That is, our analysis had to be informed by a detailed understanding of each position on the field as defined by each particular organization and scheme. He demanded nuance from his scouts, and that was not typical. The best illustration of Walsh's impact on the 49ers scouting department was the lead up to the 1986 draft. After the retirement of Fred Dean, one of the most relentless pass rushers in NFL history and an eventual Hall of Famer, the team struggled to create any pressure on the quarterback whatsoever. Walsh wanted to find someone in the draft to replace Dean, someone who could bring constant pressure, not just sack the quarterback once in a while. Walsh called me into his office to discuss what he was looking for. Out came one of his famous lists. Scratching away on those 3x5 cards with those tiny golf pencils, Walsh once compiled 30 specific details he believed made a great offensive lineman. Now in his hands was a list of criteria for the next great 49er pass rusher. 6'4" with long arms, great feet, and an explosiveness off the ball. Truth be told, Walsh was not all that concerned with how this particular player defended the run or if he had enough heft to hold up in the trenches. He had done the math, recalculated the physics, timing, and geometry of pass protection, especially in the light of the wide, sluggish offensive tackles who were populating most huddles, and realized the key was leverage, reach, and quickness. Having received my orders, I headed down to my office in the team meeting room and began to comb through scouting reports our staff had filed from the field. I eliminated players because they were too short or too slow or because their arms didn't stack up, which is to say just about every single player available. When I was done, just two collegiate footballers remained. The first was Romel Andrews, a defensive end from the University of Tennessee at Martin. The other was an outside linebacker who had been converted to an inside linebacker at tiny James Madison University, some guy named Charles Haley. I called both schools to have the players film. We used actual 16mm reels and projectors back then sent to our offices. When they arrived, I called in Walsh to watch with me. The lights dimmed, the projector flickered to life, and there was this 6'5", 255-pound Haley, a former high school basketball player with an explosive first move to match. Haley was also a tight end in high school, so he had giant strong hands, which he pistoned into defenders to create separation. His reach and stride were so long that after two steps upfield and a dip of his inside shoulder, he had the quarterback in a bear hug. On the first play we watched, Georgia Southern's excellent running quarterback, Tracy Ham, began an option play towards the side of the field away from Haley, leaving Haley several yards behind the ball right after the snap. At that point, most defenders give up, saving their energy for another down. Instead, we watched in a slack-jawed awe as Haley raced toward Ham, somehow closing the gap on one of the quickest quarterbacks in college. Just as Ham felt Haley on his back, though, he pitched the ball to the running back. Again, in normal circumstances, a trailing outside linebacker would be left in the dust. Haley quickly and instinctively slingshot himself off Ham, engulfing the running back in his long arms for the 4-yard loss. Walsh reached over, turned off the projector, and asked, "Do we need to see any more?" He had his guy. We took Haley in the fourth round. Our patience, reflecting a certainty that no other team understood Haley's value the way we did, and he registered 12 sacks as a rookie. Haley, though, was only one highlight of that 1986 draft, but more on that on Chapter 3. Until Tom Brady, he was the only player in NFL history to win 5 Super Bowls, 2 with the 49ers, 3 in Dallas, and he finished his career with 100 sacks and a bust in the Hall of Fame. The year before we drafted Haley, some of us traveled to the first ever NFL scouting combine in Tempe, Arizona to watch potential draft prospects work out in front of representatives of all the teams. On the practice field of Arizona State University, a long hot day extended deep into the night. An exhausted Walsh had no desire to sit through more, and so he summoned me to get the car to drive him back to our hotel. Once we were on the road, I could sense Walsh wasn't at all happy. He was neither doodling nor making a list, so I casually asked him what was wrong. Honestly, noting his mood, I figured my question would be ignored. To my surprise, he went on a tirade about our quarterback's coach, Paul Hackett, who was thinking of leaving. Walsh used the same incredible field that found game-changing players such as Haley to build his coaching staff. But just because he put an emphasis on loyalty, growth, and above all, obedience to his standard, it didn't mean that everyone else in his mercenary profession did. Unfortunately, Walsh took what others might consider normal job movement personally. In this case, it went beyond the prospect of losing a vital conduit of our West Coast offense. Walsh considered Hackett's solicitation of another job to be disloyal, and that was far more damaging to the team's culture than any setback in strategy. Hackett had always claimed that his lifelong ambition was to learn at the right hand of Walsh. Was that all a lie? Had Walsh fallen short of his expectations? What about the standards he set? Walsh was furious, and for the 20 miles back to the hotel, I heard all about it. Hackett ended up staying one more season before heading to Dallas in 1986 to become the offensive coordinator and heir apparent to Cowboys head coach Tom Landry. After he left, we began to look for two men to replace him. One would coach the quarterbacks, and the other would handle tight ends and wide receivers. Once again, Walsh gave me a specific list of criteria for what he wanted in potential candidates. I headed downstairs to where the 49ers stored all the college media guides. This was an era of college football in which the run-heavy option was the preferred offense, but Walsh needed someone who was comfortable throwing the football. My task was simple. I had to find bios of the few top passing offensive coordinators in the NC2A, cut them out, and glue them onto a piece of paper. The work was important, but it was not glamorous, and it wasn't long before I realized it wasn't so simple either. In many cases, the college offensive coordinator was actually not the guy most responsible for the air attack. Brigham Young University, for example, was one of the best passing schools at the time, but its coordinator by title was actually the offensive line coach, Roger French. I knew he would hold no interest for Walsh. I clipped French's bio just in case, but I also clipped the quarterback coach, Mike Holmgren. Holmgren looked promising. He was a San Francisco native, a former college quarterback at the University of Southern California, and an eighth-round pick of the St. Louis Cardinals in the 1970 draft. After his pro career fizzled, he spent a year as the offensive coordinator and quarterback coach at San Francisco State before moving to BYU. Under the direction of head coach Lavelle Edwards, the school overcame its small size to become a dominant force by breaking with the game's norms, throwing the ball all over the field. This was the kind of thinking Walsh loved. And just as had happened when we scouted Haley, Walsh took one look at Holmgren's bio and knew he had found his next right-hand man. I picked up Holmgren at the San Francisco airport twice, once for his interview and again to bring him to his new house after he took the job. Holmgren and I became good friends. He called me Scooper because I was so tuned in to what was going on around the NFL. Once in a while, though, I still reminded him that with one slice of my scissors, Roger French could have been working for the 49ers instead. The thing is, hiring coaches like Holmgren was a convoluted path to building a staff. It required Walsh to spend lots of time and energy coaching his coaches. But he lived for that kind of challenge. That's why he hired guys who were intelligent before they were anything else, guys who were not typical products of the football industry. His special teams coach, Fred Van Oppen, may still be the only coach in NFL history who read Sylvia Plath every day before heading out to the practice field. Maybe the violence of her poetry helped prepare him for the carnage of kickoff coverage. Whether they came from a Mormon university or were fans of morbid imagery, Walsh wanted men he could mold and develop. He firmly believed that coaches with too much experience in other systems would have a hard time clearing their heads of old ideas to make room for new ones. Over time, philosophies became rigid. Method and styles take root in one's DNA, making it harder to change direction or adapt to another way. Walsh was constructing something different in San Francisco, something revolutionary even, and he knew it would be very unlikely that a fully indoctrinated coach would be able to contribute to the new 49ers culture. Therefore, Walsh opted for less experienced men who shared his curiosity and displayed a willingness to learn his system and methods. I still didn't quite understand this when several weeks after Holmgren came on board, I asked Walsh during another carpool karaoke session why he hadn't hired an experienced pro coach. In particular, I knew that our vice president of player personnel, John McVay, had pushed for Lindy Infante, a veteran NFL assistant who had been the head coach of the upstart United States Football League's Jacksonville Bulls until that league folded. Infante interviewed with us, and though he seemed to have all the qualifications, he left Walsh unimpressed. "My system of offense is in place," Walsh said to me. "I'm not interested in other ideas outside the boundaries of this offense. I'd rather teach someone my system than let their creativity take over." This sounded familiar, and I soon realized why. Walsh was a big believer in the business and leadership philosophies of D. Hawk, the founder of Visa, whom the author Tom Peters often referenced in his speeches. "The problem is never how to get new innovative thoughts into your mind," Hawk said, "but how to get the old ones out." Walsh's ideas about hiring and culture were so far ahead of their time that even decades later, the best minds in the business still struggled mightily to implement their own version of the standard of performance. Many have tried to copycat Walsh's offense by hiring his former assistants and associates or anyone else who could lay claim to the West Coast lineage, believing that simply employing someone to run the scheme is enough to create the kind of success Walsh had with it. But the reason there are so many failed Walsh disciples, Ray Rhodes in Philadelphia and Green Bay, Marty Morningwig in Detroit, Mike White in Oakland, and George Seifert in Carolina, to name a few, is that Walsh installed way more than an offense. Seifert's career is the most explicit example of this misunderstanding. After taking over for Walsh in San Francisco, Seifert was 98-30 in 8 seasons, winning 2 more Super Bowls for the 49ers. Clearly, though, Seifert benefited greatly from the culture already etched in stone by Walsh. The further away the team moved from Walsh's leadership, the less success it had. Since losing their connection to Walsh, the 49ers, with only one Super Bowl appearance in the last 2-plus decades, have not been the same. Neither was Seifert. Seifert resigned from the 49ers after the 1996 season. He went 16-32 as the Panthers head coach and was fired after a disastrous 1-15 record in 2001. Seifert, you might say, knew Walsh's recipes. He had a complete understanding of the West Coast offense. He just didn't understand the most important ingredient, culture. Another example. Before University of Alabama head coach Nick Saban could become one of the greatest coaches in college football history, he had to learn the same lesson. After grinding away in the profession for almost 20 years, he got his first big break in 1991 when he was named the defensive coordinator of the Browns under Bill Belichick, himself an indirect Walsh disciple. When Saban moved on to head coaching stops of his own at Michigan State and LSU, he implemented the program made famous by Walsh and Belichick. You could see it in the way he scouted players, coached his coaches, and developed the talents of each employee. And what worked for Walsh and Belichick worked for Saban. Saban failed only once after returning to the NFL to coach the Miami Dolphins in 2005. The Dolphins at that time were still very much Don Shula's franchise. And why not? Sure, Don Shula had been retired for a decade, but the team had been one of the best in the NFL for a generation under his rule. As a result, though, Saban met with internal resistance as he tried to embed his own culture. There was zero buy-in to the new system, with players and executives alike balking at what they perceived to be a radical transformation. The final straw for Saban was the situation surrounding free agent quarterback Drew Brees. Saban knew the potential of the former Charger, but he was not allowed to sign Brees and his surgically reconstructed throwing shoulder. Brees signed with New Orleans instead, where that shoulder has thrown for more than 58,000 yards. After missing out on Brees, Saban understood that he would never be able to get the Dolphins to do the things his way, and after going 6-10 in 2006, still his only losing season as a head coach, Saban jumped to Alabama. There, he had all the freedom to build the organization from the ground up. All he's done is win 5 national championships in less than a decade. The man he took over for in Tuscaloosa, Don's son Mike. One of Walsh's frequently repeated decrees was, "Don't be a copycat." It made him crazy when opposing coaches would attend clinics on the West Coast offense just so they could steal his play designs, mostly because it implied that pass routes were the key to the 49ers' success. They missed the fundamental point, the true genius of it all, and that angered Walsh to no end. The inevitable failures of those wannabes, and the particular cautionary tale of George Seifert, for that matter, led me to formulate a little theory of my own, the Emeril Lagasse theory. Lagasse, as you may know, is a longtime New Orleans restaurateur and best-selling cookbook author who was a television personality in the first wave of celebrity chefs. His food is delicious and his recipes are easy to follow, yet he never feared that another aspiring cook would usurp his work. He knew that being able to follow a recipe is a very different thing from duplicating a particular and personal culinary ethos. It is the creator alone who understands just what the dish is trying to accomplish, and so he's the only one who knows just how to make the ingredients work together. Lagasse also knows that, as with an assembly line or a football franchise, the smallest deviation from the process upends the final product, especially if it's andouille gumbo. That's why there's no need to worry about knockoff restaurants. If copycatting were a useful shortcut to success, there would be Lagasse-style restaurants in every city and San Francisco 49er clones in every football stadium. Or today, New England Patriots clones. The now famous Patriot Way, the unique and uniquely powerful culture Belichick has honed over the last decade and a half, is a living tribute to Walsh's standard of performance and his revolutionary organizational philosophies. And like Walsh, many of Belichick's disciples, most prominently Charlie Weiss and Josh McDaniels, have failed as head coaches after, to keep the cooking metaphor going, stepping out of the frying pan and into the fire. They knew all their mentors' recipes. They just didn't know how to cook them. Few grasp what was behind the dynasty in San Francisco then or in New England now. The details, the mindset, the superhuman sacrifices made every second of every day to establish and maintain another commitment to the culture. Every NFL owner wants his team to be the next Patriots, the next link in the Walsh chain, until realizing how challenging the task is. They all lose their appetite to see an overhaul through to the end. You can't cook up success unless you've created the right culture. It doesn't work. Just ask Emeril. Chapter 2. The Coach. A Study in Leadership. Flying by the seat of his pants always suggests to me a leader who hasn't prepared properly and whose pants may soon fall down. Bill Walsh. In The Godfather Part 2, Michael Corleone asks Frank Pantangeli to make peace with the Rosato brothers. Pantangeli hates the idea. He knows that neither side has an interest in settling and that any meeting will be a waste of his time. In 1996, I had my own Godfather moment. John Shaw, then the president of the St. Louis Rams, asked me to meet with his vice president of football operations, Steve Ortmeier. The team had no openings in its personnel department. Shaw just wanted to gauge if Ortmeier was open to some outside assistance. Like Pantangeli, I knew Ortmeier would be against the idea. strongly. He was going to guard his turf. I expected that the trip to Macomb, Illinois, the new summer home of the recently relocated Rams, was going to be like a meeting with the Rosado brothers, a total waste of time. Instead, my Frankie Five Angels meeting with the Rams was the beginning of a bizarre but fascinating